I have made a decision. I'm going to quit.
Okay.
I'm quitting.
Quitting what?
Well, W.C. Fields is reportedly the person who said that, because, it's always important to keep trying and working and, just stick with it, the old college try, right?
Sure.
Only quitters quit, winners never quit, winners keep going, right?
It's, okay.
Yeah, man, I'm going to quit.
Quit what?
Well, W.C. Fields said, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And, well, if you don't succeed, then try something else. It's time to move on. So the last of the VCR manufacturers stopped making VCR tapes in July of 2016. So I just thought that we should probably talk about, to begin with, the importance of quitting. The VCR cassette recorder was insanely popular. Began its run around 1956, and so that would be 66, 76, 86, 96, 2006, 2016. That's 60 years. That's a pretty good run.
Yeah.
But, it's done. Somebody has finally thrown in a towel, and they quit.
Interesting. I had no idea they manufactured them that late, honestly.
Yeah, so if you want a VCR tape, you better hurry up and go out and buy it because your VCR is not only going to become obsolete, but won't be able to play anything soon. And the reason I brought that up is because I'm going to be going to a city council meeting here in Ocala, and once again, we have a group of people that are going to raise issues that they need to quit and move on. And I've got this book by Annie Duke. Is it Annie Duke? Whatever, it doesn't make any difference. I think it's Annie Duke. I'll think about it in a minute. But it's the word quit. And it's the importance of knowing when to quit. And she's written some pretty good things, thinking in terms of bets and other books. I've gotten through about the first 6-7 chapters of it. It's amazing. And I've talked a little bit about this. But you would think people, especially in the world today that we are looking at, would know when to throw the towel in.
No, these days, especially with social media connecting everybody in ever greater high speed frequency. People's identities are tied with their social media and their personal causes that they advocate for. So they seems to me more and more often we have people willing to die on just the smallest anthills imaginable and not actually capable or even willing to end or shift gears or, let's say, find an alternative path to solving their problems. Instead, it's kind of like this topic we keep coming back to. Some of the stuff you see in particular in Ukraine, it's like, what are the Russians doing? Why don't they shift strategies or change what they're doing or whatever? And yeah, it's actually quite wild.
Well, Annie Duke is a 58-year-old lady who won the 2004 World Series of Poker, and she is a poker champion. She knows how to bet. She's got a couple books out there, Thinking in Terms of Bets, How to Decide to Play Great Poker, and now she has written a book, Quit. And I think that's a great segue for the Russians. You are continuing to basically do what was done during the Revolutionary War, which is just throw mass numbers of people forward. And, they're just slaughtering them. And I just...
Yeah. Time and time again, I see things and you look at the after action on skirmishes or battles or whatever you want to call it. And it's really amazing to see what amounts to a very large, competent to some degree, organized army that
go down in utter flames.
Well, it's not that they go down in flames. They just continue to do the same stupid thing over and over and over and over. And it's like, they learn some lessons and change tactics occasionally, but it's just so slow. It's like imagine the worst bureaucracy you can imagine that you've ever dealt with in your entire life. For some people, this is going to be the Postal Service, or it's going to be Social Security Administration, or the VA, or
Vanguard.
Vanguard.
The absolute worst broker-dealer on the face of the earth if you have administrative needs.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when somebody dies.
Oh, it's,
complete incompetence, followed by Truist.
Yeah, so that's something, we'll round back to that, because I actually have some thoughts on this. But, imagine the worst bureaucracy you've ever been had the pleasure to deal with in your life, and that looks at the outset anyway, from our perspective, what the Russian military is like. People who seemingly have competence and notice the problems are often shunned and told to basically just go die in a hole someplace because, you know, you can't embarrass people. You have to kowtow to certain interests and, you know, your superiors not only have their careers and all of this on the line, but they also have, you know, all of their corruption and graft on the line as well. So, you know, I'm reminded of a story where some Wagner soldiers or mercenaries or whatever at one point, sometime after Prigozhin was assassinated. Sometime within the past year, some Wagner soldiers were like, okay, well, we're being forced into this area and we're taking up regular responsibilities, and they shifted a lot of the command structure around. And anyway, long story short, they were out in the field doing something, and these guys were attached to a more traditional Russian army unit. And they found that a whole bunch of these guys were on drugs. And in particular, they've got this one guy, and you know, they did what the Russians do far too often. They, you know, humiliate and torture people until they speak. And this guy gave up who his drug dealer was, and it traced it up the ladder inside his command structure, and they figured out where the drugs were coming to in this area. They were able to figure out exactly who was responsible and who was trafficking the drugs and all this sort of stuff. They then gave this information to some contacts within, I want to say, the FSB, which is their kind of like quasi-CIA FBI organization for domestic purposes. And they gave...
I hope they're better than our FBI.
Yeah, no.
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 That was a throwaway.
Our FBI are saints by comparison, and that's saying something. No. So anyway, they gave this information up the chain of command to the FSB's unit that investigates, like, basically corruption or something. Yeah, and instead the FSB dispatched, or the military dispatched, some special forces to go hunt down and kill these guys as if they were traitors.
Okay.
Yeah. Not the drug dealers, the guys that reported the drug dealers. Yeah, it's insane. Like, the stuff that you see, you know, the amount of, again, corruption and graft and stuff that is associated with their military, and what's on the line for a lot of these people is very different than what we're used to. I mean, we've kind of talked about this in the past, but, you know, officers in our military often like to complain about the corruption and all the various things. But the corruption in our military typically happens afterwards. You get out of the military and you've done your service and whatever, and now you're being paid handsomely in some cases for access to or information about how certain things are used, and how can you help us design a program or a tool or something, get us an edge into selling into the military industrial complex government pipeline, right? You know, and of course you're also buying connections and, you know, how to get in front of the right people and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I'll come back to this, but that's easy to stop if anybody wanted to do it.
But in some respects, it's actually a good thing because these companies hire people who actually have real experience, and they design and build things that are actually useful for people who have experience on the ground and not just some design by committee hellscape, which is what most of the government is. So on one hand, you can say it's bad, but on the other hand, it's like, okay, well, you know, it has its pros and cons. Like, everything is not as simple as it seems to be on the outside. But anyway, point is, you know, you view it from that perspective. At least our corruption happens after these guys are no longer in our military. These people, if you view it as corruption, these guys are actively, you know, like, oh, I have, 400 soldiers under my command, and 200 of them are real, and 200 of them are... I'm pocketing their salary for my yacht.
Yeah, and of the 200 that are there, the 100 of them had boots, and the other 100 have flip-flops.
Oh, well, yeah, because everybody has to
take seen that.
Everybody has to take their piece all the way down. Yeah. That's the thing, is when corruption inside the organization becomes the status quo, and you see this in China, and you see this in Russia in particular, obviously this is very common in all kind of Marxist or communist countries throughout history, but Russia and China are big examples of this. You get endemic corruption that is just systemic to an organization, and you find out really quickly what Venezuela has found out. You know, they beat their chests and, oh, we're going to go after Guyana for their oil. And they find out that, oh, well, because of the way Chavez and the Maduro have managed keeping the military loyal by giving, you know, training budgets to people's bonuses and things like this. Turns out you don't really have a military that's capable of doing anything other than crushing dissent. Who would have thought?
You mean they can't go in and kick a little tiny country with a handful of people?
Yeah,
that
4 million person population, giant Venezuela. No, they couldn't even get over there if they wanted to. There's no roads. So you're either going to march to the jungle or you're going to get like a bunch of fishing boats and you're going to land hop or ocean or a water hop across the coast. It's just, it's comical. You couldn't logistically support any serious invasion of the country if you wanted to. So anyway, point is just, you know, when you start to understand these really like deep-seated, deep-rooted realities of how these countries work, it explains a lot. And at least in our system, as messed up as it can be at times, it's, you know, that type of corruption is just simply not tolerated.
Something that popped in my mind when you were saying this is my favorite phrase I could hardly get out of my mouth, a Potemkin village.
Yes.
I have a new phrase on that. How about a Potemkin? Man, I suck at this. Help me out, son.
Potemkin.
Thank you. Potemkin. Say it.
Potemkin.
Parade and a what?
Potemkin.
Military. Think about it. If you apply the same thing to, you know, the fake village,
yeah.
And now you have your fake parades where, oh, the Chinese, if I could only get the word out, I'm something tongue-tied on that. Always been that way. You get your Chinese and, oh, they're so, you know, boy, they're powerful. Or you got the Russians and all their missiles from years ago. Now if they do one of those May Day parades, what are they going to do for tanks? They're going to put out fake tanks now?
Well, the Russian one has been comical. If you look at their parade in like 2020 and then 2021 and then 2022 and then 2023, and the one this year should be very telling because last year they went from all these tanks and all these giant things down to the one in Moscow had one I don't know what it was, a T-34, like World War II T-34. Obviously, none of them are in current operation, Russia, but they have a few for parade purposes. So they, you know, obviously
they could come up with the Tsar tank, the bizarre thing they had from World War One.
I don't even know that the Russians really had any significant use of tanks in World War One because
it really wasn't a tank. It was just a,
well, yeah, but you know, the development of tanks was largely on the Western front of World War One, and it just, you know, things like slowly evolved over time.
But
by the middle of the war, the Russians had capitulated because communists had basically infiltrated the government and then laid siege against the Tsarist government. So I don't know. There probably wasn't much development on that front.
The Tsar tank is a good indication of what Russia technology was and continues to be occasionally. It was a tricycle, basically. It didn't have caterpillar tracks. Instead, it was basically a tricycle. The two front wheels were kind of spoked and nearly 30 feet in diameter.
It's a different era.
Different world we live in.
Yeah. The best part is look at the weight.
Oh, my goodness.
60 tons.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. You know, bigger's better, right? Bigger's always better.
Yeah. Well, so to kind of round back about the criticism about Vanguard and some of these other people. So there's an interesting phenomenon that's happened since COVID. And, you know, imagine we're back in, you know, late winter, early spring of 2020 again. Everybody's starting to think about shutdowns and people are panicking that we're all going to die and your lungs are going to fill up with goo, right? Because, I mean, that was the...
Yeah, I do believe I died 37 times. And,
but to be fair, yeah. I mean, in that time period, there was minimal information. The communication about what information was out there was very poor by pretty much everybody. And because there was so much, let's just call it incompetence by people in the government, everybody was very willing to fear the worst because of just how poorly managed the response to a lot of this was. So anyway... In this time period, okay, we have to say to people, you have to work from home. Well, most organizations were able to manage that transition pretty well, even big ones. But so, like, let's look at a company like, you know, let's say a nameless, large, an international broker-dealer and custodian, because they pretty much all work the same. But anyway.
We're going to be nice, right?
What do you do? What do? You have thousands of people in customer support, and now that customer support isn't going to go away. If anything, it's going to get worse because people are going to need to liquidate accounts and make withdrawals and do stuff to just stay alive.
Correct.
But you still need this huge staff.
And these people have access to information that they cannot and should not be leaving the building with.
Oh, yeah. Historically speaking, I mean, you know, a lot of these companies, this is one of the weird parts about it is... a lot of these companies, their entire security infrastructure is designed around nothing leaving the physical structure. You know, certain key select employees might have access to a highly monitored VPN to get into a secure resources, but it's very limited. There was just a tectonic shift in how to deal with things at this point in time. There's dozens of anecdotes that are coming up in my mind of technologies and tools that went from niche, interesting, kind of, yeah, maybe distributed companies that have offices all over the place could benefit from this tech to, it's not just we need to connect 10 offices together, now we need 10,000 employees to be able to access this kind of technology, and the scaling and the implementation of these tools to securely give certain people access to things. It's just, my mind is just kind of exploding with, again, anecdotes that don't really matter, but people really don't kind of, hindsight is 2020, but people don't really see the magnitude of work that went into enabling this kind of knee-jerk transition that was necessary.
And I remember having a very specific conversation with a number of people where I have experience in this area because, gosh, it's about 20 plus years ago now that we had Truesdell Accounting. We shut that down because it was a lost leader, and I'm not going to do any more businesses that are lost leaders. But one of the things we thought about doing is we were going to hire some CPAs, and we were going to use a firm in India, if you recall. You were younger, of course, at the time. And in India, they have CAs. They don't have CPAs. They have chartered accountants. And the firm that we were going to consider having to do taxes, because the internet was becoming a real thing. You could get data from one side of the world to the other. And while we could be working during the day, they're sleeping. And when we're done at the day, you'd have a little bit of a overlap, and then they're sure. doing their work at night. You know, by the time you come back the next day, it's in your inbox. And so what would happen is they would do the majority of the prep work on the tax return, and then our people would just finish it up. Okay. With that being said, I learned a lot about technology, and back then the emphasis was these people go into the boys go into the boys' room, the girls go in the girls' room locker, and they remove their clothes and they put on their jumpsuits, and they have no phones, and they have true dumb terminals. They cannot access because they got name, address, social security, they got everything. So this is a bonanza identity theft.
Number one time for identity theft is tax season. When your refunds are coming in the mail or people are sending their returns out, on a theft that happens of those is tremendous. And you have a return, you pretty much can clone anybody's identity if you need to.
And so one of the things that I gave up on that, and I quit. We quit the accounting practice. We sold it to another firm. Because I could not have a rational discussion with anyone, and I mean anyone, about the policies and procedures that I felt needed to take place. The E&O, the liability, everything was just either somebody was completely in denial or they would be, nothing was good enough. And it was just, again, I started off with the word quit.
Sure. Yeah, so these big firms, you know, you look at the transition that happened, it's tremendous. But the thing is, at the time, you know, there's a couple things that people don't really understand changed. Behind the scenes, a lot of these, let's call them customer support people, they went from working in a large office or, you know, units, right? You're in a room with, you know, cubicles or whatever with maybe 10, 12 other people, and it's a... You're in charge of a certain kind of support for, you know, let's say IRAs, if we're talking about brokerage firm, right? Or trust accounts or corporate accounts or whatever the situation is.
And everybody listening should understand that in customer service departments all across this country, in the financial services industry, many of them are massively large. The ones that are smaller have very highly technical people who are paid a lot of money, but the problem is volume of calls. Absolutely. So in essence, over time, you have a dilution of knowledge and you have somebody sitting on the top of the heap knows a lot. Yeah. And as a result, you have really siloed responses. So go ahead.
Yeah. And so, you know, you've got all these people with all this support capability. And like you said, is 100% correct. That's what I was leading to, is you have people who have institutional knowledge. You know, our processes and procedures cover X. And if you want to do this weird niche thing, it's like, well, we have a special form. We can email it to you or mail it or whatever. Or, you know, you need a certain thing to happen. It's an exception basis only. Well, okay, here's the process and here's who we need to get a hold of to process that internally. Some of these things are made obscure or difficult intentionally, purely because they're a security risk. A good example are... whole account transfers from one taxable entity to another, those are rare. I mean, we've done them, especially they're more common when you're dealing with a state settlement. But those are a very rare thing that typically there's a process behind the scenes and, you know, somebody has to get you whatever the special process is and initiate it. Anyway, so long story short, you know, you have a customer support institution, really, where, you know, your individual frontline first response type people may not have the capability of solving the problem, but they can put you on hold and ask their manager who's two desks over.
Bingo.
Or whatever the problem is, right? They can, you know, if that person doesn't know, he can get a hold of, you know, somebody else that he knows that has maybe more experience, or maybe they have a dedicated person for this type of weird request, or whatever the problem is, right? You know, you can look over and say, oh, okay, that was on Bob's desk. He was supposed to handle this, and he's not in the office today. So you can actually give, like, actual useful information to people. Instead, you know, COVID happened, and people migrated to this totally online digital customer support service center that is a thing that's been around for a long time. It's not new, distributed in the era prior to COVID. The predominant use of these tools were for offshore customer support centers where, you know, your managers may be in the United States still, but the actual people doing the frontline customer support are in Mexico or India or the Philippines or some other place.
Let me jump in there for a second, because we were one of the very first families that had an opportunity to use out-of-state customer service. We went to a McDonald's in right outside of Yellowstone National Park. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I do.
And
it was a test thing they did.
But the lady who took our order was very nice and pleasant. Everything was wonderful. The people working there were interesting, very similar to the people who we met. We were at Laredo, I think, on the Mexico-Texas border. Where were we at?
Douglas. Hmm? Douglas, Arizona.
We were at Douglas, Arizona. And that was
interesting. It's a horrible place. Never go.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it's like right now. It's probably like, it probably literally is Mexico. I mean, with the lack of border enforcement, the border there, you can literally like see the holes in the fence, at least back then, and you could like walk through them if you wanted to.
Yeah, and
Border Patrol people were, this is back when, you know, at least in theory, Border Patrol was doing something. This is 2005. And even then, they were just kind of like driving around looking at people. They didn't care.
Who was the, Sean, was it Sean Hannity on Fox? Yes, that's what
he's he is a Fox host. Yes.
Yeah. Well, this was back in the day when we had some connections in Fox because of going to the conventions and everything else, you know, blah, blah, blah. You had that guy who went to CNN, Shepard something, Smith. Anyhow.
I think he's on CNBC.
He's on CNBC now. Well, we all had a connection back in the day.
Or MSNBC.
And we actually had emails and text messages back and forth. Remember, I still have pictures of the water bottles and the sleeping arrangements under the Border Patrol infrared cameras.
Yeah, they had these observation posts, like trailers with cameras and communications and stuff. And yeah, underneath these trailers were, you know, supplies for coyotes. It was the border situation has been a joke basically forever. And anybody who says they're going to solve it is very much lacks a large perspective on how this stuff actually goes down. They go down and I'm going to go tour the border and I'm going to go look, and they go down and look and they see a microcosm of a very large systemic problem that basically nobody has the stomach or initiative to actually solve.
So the reason I brought all that up is that because we're outside Yellowstone, excuse me a second, we're in outside Yellowstone and we've got this beautiful, pristine, English-speaking, Midwestern voice, and the lady comes on, and we get our order. And the people inside were interesting. I'll just leave it at that. During the same trip, we wound up going to Douglas. We get down to the border. Same thing, we're going to go through McDonald's, and we couldn't, I don't know if you remember, we could not order the drive-through because we didn't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
Could not do it. So we wouldn't leave you guys in the car. We all went in, and I think you guys huddled onto our legs, and we placed our order. But the thing there, going back to customer service where it takes people, I've never seen so many people behind a counter, and everybody had their own job. Mm-hmm. And this one person just sat there filling the soda pop machine. The other was just doing the milkshake. One person was just getting cups and handing to them. It's like, wow, this is make work to the nth degree.
Yeah.
So you got to think about this. The world is an interesting place. And you think everything works like it does in your neighborhood. It doesn't. You got to get out and look at things. So go ahead and get going.
So these customer support platforms, you know, were designed at least initially for offshore customer support. That's really what it was for. And, you know, for the implementation during the COVID period, everybody may be domestic. Who knows? It doesn't even really matter because you get the same problems that everybody that offshored this stuff dealt with. Differences is some of these people hopefully have some experience. But as we know, people change jobs and whatever, and it's been 2-3 years. And now you have people that all they've ever done is do work from home for these companies. So specifically with big giant behemoth Vanguard, their customer support is very interesting because you get a hold of somebody in the front line and, you know, you need to escalate something to a manager or, you know, you need to get them to do something that they don't have the ability to do. Guess what happens?
Well, I do know that it's a standby hell.
No, it's worse. That's the person you're going to talk to. They're in order to talk to somebody that has more authority than them. They can't put you on hold. They use text chat. They're manager.
Oh, they don't put anybody on hold anymore? Because I've had that. I don't do any really of administration here, but I've had people put them on hold and they come back. Like, let me just talk to your supervisor. You can't get to them.
It very much depends on the organization and their protocols for stuff. With Vanguard, all of their managers, my experience and what I've heard, is all by they have to type out and ask the person what they should be doing.
Interesting.
And they can transfer people around to other people with support capabilities, but you will never speak to somebody that is a manager or somebody at a higher level. So it's interesting because, you know, from what I've heard in particular with more sophisticated, more let's call it technical requests, the issue seems to be, at least just my intuition anyway, is that these people have a limited amount of access to certain things and they need to be able to do something more. And now they're asking for permission, you know, based on the call. And this person's probably reviewing the call up to this point to see if that was actually part of the request. And so you have all these layers of access control because obviously, you know, somebody sitting at, in their apartment someplace in, you know, Poughkeepsie, you know, you don't want them to be able to just pull up everybody's account and be able to do, you know, identity theft. It's point is it's a nightmare. And the other thing is you've lost, you've taken something that historically would have been very simple. Okay, you're calling from this number, use some other information to verify somebody's identity. Okay, great. Pull up your account, Okay, I don't, this isn't my expertise. Let me transfer you to, you know, the irrevocable trust or business trust department. And they're going to be able to solve this problem for you. I've already authenticated you. Okay, hand off. This person that gets 3 phone calls a day because nobody deals with these things. Done. They can work your problem. Done. Now it's, oh, what is that? I was on a phone call with another firm. I mentioned who it is. And I had a question about a 1035 that should have been received by a client account. I literally had somebody in advisor support services ask, what's a 1035?
That's like a realtor says, what's a 1031?
Yeah. And I was like, I really had to pause for a moment and just kind of collect myself. I explained it to the person who I hope was not an intern. Anyway, I was just, you don't have the institutional knowledge like you used to. And more importantly, you don't have this situation where you can just turn around or put you on hold and walk over to your supervisor's desk and ask, hey, I've got this weird problem. And talk to him, or can you help me figure out what I need to do to be able to do this? Instead, you're pleading with somebody on text chat, and you know you probably don't even know what this person looks like. And on top of that, also consider the efficiencies at play. I mean, oh, wow, they can do analytics on how many people they need to do things. And, oh, well, we can actually fit because we don't have any constraints in our offices anymore. Well, you're a manager of this support group. Well, we can double your workload easily.
Yeah.
Because, you know, hey.
We'll just make everything chat. You know, just AI. You just pop your question and get it squared around.
Yeah.
So one of the things I want to add to that is.
There's just a ton of things you can think of here that it makes everything harder.
One of the things I want to add is that, you know, the old-fashioned water coolers. I don't think a lot of people know what a water cooler is. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But, you know, it used to be in a day. Any office in the morning around the coffee pot, around the water cooler, you talked about what happened on TV, the Johnny Carson show.
Sure.
You talked about what happened with the TV show MASH and All in the Family and people, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, and you had some cities had UHF and a lot of cities didn't have cable. Of course, that was brand new. When HBO came out, it was like, what's this?
Yep.
I remember saying, why? why would you want to get this thing with all movies? Just go to the movies, right? So anyhow, but you lose that ability to just chit-chat. And that's...
Yeah, that is where the institutional knowledge is created and honed. And this is the thing that, you know, a lot of companies have realized is, yeah, I mean, you can have people working from home doing a fraction of the hours they would normally work in reality. Know, let's say you're paid for 8, but you actually, you know, they're tracking everything you're doing. You're doing about 4 hours of work, but they also are finding that in that 4 hours, you're doing, you know, substantially more work than you would get done in an 8-hour shift at an office. Every business is different. I've seen some interesting studies that kind of prove this out, that work from home, especially with very analytical work, people are getting more done in a much,
it's not being disturbed.
Yeah, but it's a substantially shorter period of time. But despite that, there's a reason these companies are like, we don't care. We're coming back to the office or you are fired. And the reason is you lose. You can coast on this momentum, this knowledge momentum that you have in an organization for a while. But once you start to reach a certain, there's a precipice of turnover. Once you reach that critical mass of turnover inside an organization, you will lose a lot in a company. And that's one thing I can tell you that you can visibly see it in some institutions now. They just simply don't have the it anymore because there's no communication happening. These people are like, okay, I have my work done. I'm going to go for a walk now. I mean, you can see them. You can, if you're out driving around, looking at people doing things, you'll see people that, why is there what looks like a mid-30s couple just on a walk at 3 p.m. on a Tuesday?
Right.
Like, but it's not just one. You'll see 3, 4, 5 couples doing the same thing in an
area. We talked about this recently. Yeah.
Exactly. In an area that's full of, you know, let's call it more working class residential communities, that you would have never seen that before.
And these are not people that look like they're doing shift work.
No, no, no.
Because you can always spot that.
Yeah, you can usually spot that. But no, they look like traditional working class employees. But the thing that's obvious is these people are working from home, or at least a portion of them are. So they're, you know, they got their hours in, or they're working later, or whatever the situation is, or they're in a case where, you know, nobody's monitoring what they're doing. So, you know, they don't have any appointments scheduled. So what are they going to do? They're just, or meetings scheduled. So what are they going to do? I'm just going to go walk the dog and go do something for the next hour and, you know, get an hour of pay for leisure activity. So anyway, it's interesting because these people aren't doing there's not the employee to employee communication, and
Zoom doesn't cut it.
No, it doesn't. You know, I'm sure certain jobs, certain, you know, specialties where there is a lot of communication required, you know, they've made do and you do what you have to do, even if Zoom is your option. But not every job is like that. A lot of education and a lot of knowledge and how these companies work comes from just osmosis, being around, seeing something happen, talking to somebody, like you said, the water cooler talk or the break room talk, and talking to people as you're walking down to your car, in the elevator, going up the stairs, whatever the case is.
Right. Going to kind of relate, but there's a reason why Apple flies daily multiple flights back and forth between California and China.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I can't remember the number, but I think when I remember reading this is a couple of years ago, but they had a steady thing from, I think, American Airlines, and it was like two or three planes a day going there and coming back a day. Yeah. So you had people, teams of people, their entire job was to go over there, check things, make sure things are working properly, spend a day or two, and then you come back
sniffing dirt and kicking tires, as I say. I'm going to give a quick little item. I want to get my little quote out, and then I want you to think about it, and then we're going to get out of here because I got to get on the road. We've done this long enough. It'll be a little shorter version, but the one thing is, not everything that can, now listen to this very carefully, not everything that can be counted counts. Let me repeat that. Not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. So I think one of the things we've done here with our firms, I've kind of really stressed this a lot, is we continually bridge the gap between the things that can be counted and the things that count. And what I mean by that, when I said about quitting, there are some companies that should fold up the tent and go out of business. And you're seeing that in the electrical vehicle area. I think you're going to begin seeing more and more people are going to say, like this, we have this wackadoodle who is promoting in the Biden administration that 100% of all military vehicles have to be EV. They have to be electric. You know, just quit. Go away. Get out of here. Same thing with some of our politicians who don't ever seem to go away.
I will say the EV military thing, that is something we should revisit, because I actually do know a little bit about some of the projects that are ongoing. Some of them are genius, and they provide a tactical capability that otherwise would not be possible. But
no,
making this mass statement like, you know, somebody from California would,
right,
with regard to it, is just incredibly dumb.
No, there is the power of energy in whatever form it comes from is a force multiplier. And before we wrap this up, always remember, never forget, that I'm Paul the Elder. He's Paul the Younger. We're with Truesdell Wealth, and that is a registered investment advisor. And one of our fortes, one of our specialities, is the Defense Department of the United States military, war, machinery, personnel. It's what we do. That's why we talk a lot about that, because we have a portfolio called our military procurement portfolio. So just remember that. And we're biased in that area. And we work it really hard. But the point being, the number of innovations, the technology that has come from a war, and it's never going to end. People just can't get along. I mean, we've been killing each other over whose imaginary friend is more real than anything else. So, you know, with that being said, I'm really proud of how we do things here. And again, capturing not just the attention of people, but, you know, being experts ahead of the curve where people go, oh, subprime mortgages, they suck. Yeah, I did a lot of, do you remember all the seminars I talked on that back in the day before, you know, in 2006 and 2007, I kept saying, this, you can fog a mirror and get a mortgage and then they sell it. It's called securitization of crap.
Yeah.
You know, that was my actual title of my seminar. It was called Securitization of Crap, that you literally take dog dirt, if you put it in a really pretty box and you seal it up and you put the wrapping paper on it, you put a pretty bow on it, and oh, you got a present, but it's dog crap on the inside. When you open it up, it's, wow, I couldn't smell it because I had it hermetically sealed. And that's what securitization of Augamir mortgages were. And it was the easiest way for me to explain it to people.
Well, literally all they were doing is just diversifying a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And the issue was, is back then, the regulators and the ratings companies and everybody allowed the, let's call it the classification of crap to be much more beneficial to the companies that are trying to offload the crap.
They were in cahoots.
Well, or in the case of, you know, the ratings companies, they just didn't care. Like, we're getting paid, we'll stamp your thing, whatever we want to do, or whatever makes you write the check. You know, it's the issue in that entire thing goes back to, you know, when you're relieving yourselves of a huge burden. The person that's relieving themselves of the burden, particular long held debt obligations, maybe that person is more likely to lie about what's in there.
Yeah.
Maybe more scrutiny is important.
You don't have skin in the game. You tend to let things slide. Hey, before I forget real quick, have you heard of a company called C-Tech Astronomy? C-Tech Astronomy. Anybody know what that means? Well, it's a movie from 1992.
It's a company from a movie.
That's right. It's the movie Sneakers. And I'm going to tell you who was in this thing. You had Robert Redford, Dan Aykroyd, Ben Kingsley. You had River Phoenix, Sidney Poitier. It was an amazing movie.
I've seen it about maybe 200 times might be an understatement.
And it's a great movie. I mean, it just really is. And the reason is that when you unravel C-Tech Astronomy, it's too many secrets. And so it's just a great movie. I'm not going to give you all the details of it. If you haven't seen it, go see it. If you have seen it, go watch it again. And remember what I'm going to tell you. C-Tech Astronomy and Too Many Secrets, hackers, corporate espionage, government espionage, taking your data, Russians being involved in everything you can possibly imagine, Chinese, you know, yeah, go to your Chinese restaurant and give them your credit card, and basically you're just giving them your ID. I'm telling you, we can go on for hours on this stuff. It's not new. It's just not. It just seems like it takes 30, 40 years for people to go, oh, I didn't know that. Sometimes it's frustrating. A couple of final words and thoughts, and then we'll get out of here.
Yeah, I guess the movie Sneakers is interesting because obviously it has a liberal slant to it that's kind of funny in hindsight. It's kind of a juvenile. But yeah, I guess as the movie wraps up, it's interesting because this magical encryption device that... you know, it's interesting in hindsight, this movie was created around the peak of the, I guess it's called the first round of the crypto wars.
That's correct. Which
we're not talking about cryptocurrency, we're talking about cryptography. This is a time period when Congress tried to regulate backdoors into all cryptography and, you know, it was a big thing. You know, there's all these fights about, I won't buy a computer that has, you know, these management chips and these DRM and this cryptography backdoors in it. And of course, the hilarious thing is the government capitulated and gave up largely because of movies like this, where they, you know, pointed out how dangerous a backdoor in all technology could be. And if you recall, you know, at the end of the movie, there's a news report talking about how the Republican National Committee was bankrupt and large donations were given to Amnesty International and the United Negro College Fund and various things.
And Greenpeace.
And how, you know, basically the implication, obviously, is that, you know, this magical backdoor cryptography thing that they had had stolen from this company who was working with the government. They had been they decided to start using it for good, for to help people instead of, you know, the horrible conservatives. Anyway, so the point is that you know, this actually did happen in reality, not this story, but the crypto wars, and there's a war is obviously a bit of an exaggeration, but it was a huge let's call it debate and attempts by the government to do various things. And the people obviously behind the scenes helping Congress and other the agencies with their various legislative attempts obviously were smart enough to sit back and say, yeah, this is dumb. Let's not do that. Instead, let's invest money in code breaking and all kinds of other technology that makes that allows everybody to feel safe. At the same time, we will still be able to have all the information we need. And that's the world we live in now. I mean, you know, there's a reason the Iranians, nobody inside the Iranian government can probably, let's say, use the bathroom or fart without us knowing about it. I'm reminded of a scene from Body of Lies where Russell Crowe's character is talking to the head of the Jordanian intelligence service, and he says, he's like the terrorists may not use their phones, but you sure like to use yours, implying that they know exactly what they're doing. Like we're spying on you while you're spying on other people. Why do we need the big network when we can just let you do what you do and we'll come in and plug the holes where we think you're missing or whatever. So anyway, point is, like, these are things, you know. Sneakers is from 92, and, you know, Body of Lies obviously is probably almost 20 years old now. But anyway, it was about the Iraq war in particular and intelligence and how the terrorists were realizing that using technology was getting them caught because whatever, and how they started to shift underground, which is a thing that did happen. Started to shift to, you know, human carriers of notes and orders and things, and it made people's lives a lot harder. But anyway, it's interesting because, you know, as time goes on, it is very obvious, people are just more distracted than ever, that if they want to know something, it's not about a matter of time. They already do know it. You just have to look into the pile of stuff they've collected. And like you said, not everything that's countable is important. Well, the same thing goes for data. It's not about, you know, the data collection is phase one. It's about being able to process the data that is the valuable thing.
The old phrase, garbage in, garbage out?
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, you know, collecting a lot of extra data, even though it seems nonsensical at the moment that you're doing the collection, sometimes you'll be able to get an insight later that you need all that crap to go through to create that insight. So, you know, or in the case of a lot of criminal cases now, in particular with a homicide, an absence of data is a pattern in and of itself. And we've had multiple people get caught because, oh, you never turn your phone off, but yet the moment in time that this person was being killed and the timeline that we've constructed that you would have been necessary for you to do this, your phone was for some reason off. You know, and there's been actually a few convictions, or maybe not convictions, but investigations that have enabled the absence of data has been just as important as the existence of said data. So anyway, it's very important. It's interesting, and from the very large perspective, yeah, data comes in all forms, and sometimes, like you said, you need to quit or change. And in the case of like the data support centers, just because it made sense in 2020 and 2021 doesn't mean it makes sense in 2024.
So we began with the word quit. I talked a little bit about Annie Duke, and I'm going to round back around with that. I want to congratulate her for going back to college after 30 years, a very successful career. She obtained her PhD in June of last year, 2023. Congratulations, Annie. She got her PhD in cognitive psychology. So she, you know, a lot of people go to school, they get their education, they get their PhD, and then they learn the real world. Well, she learned the real world and went back. To wrap up, not everything that can be counted counts. And again, she is an amazing person who can calculate numbers. She's a forecaster like Paul and I. And she is an amazing person. You got to get her books. I would read every one very thoroughly. Read it with a pen and paper, highlighter, and take notes. Read it like it's the Bible. She's a good egg. And so with that, not everything that can be counted counts. Not everything that counts can be counted. With that, our time is done. My name is Paul Truesdell. I'm Paul the Elder.
And I'm Paul the Younger.
And we're out of here. Tip a canoe, Tyler 2. That's it.
You have been listening to the Paul Truesdell podcast. For additional items, serious to humorous, wisdom to occasional outrage, of various degrees, visit paultruesdell.com. That's paultruesdell.com.
Paul Grant Truesdell.
Roger that, dust off in five. On the floor, now!